Right, hello. Thank you very much for coming this evening, for being so prompt and getting your book signed before the event, which is quite a novelty for us, but thank you very much for coming. Welcome to Woodbridge Library. Before I start, I do need to tell you where the emergency exits are. So it's where you came in and also in the far corner at the back. And that's that. So I'm Catherine Lana, and on behalf of Browser's Bookshop, I'm very pleased that we've been able to arrange this evening and have Joanne Harris visit us, which is very exciting. We're going to be talking together for about 40 minutes, then there'll be the opportunity for some questions. And if you haven't had your book signed already, then we'll be doing a little bit, well, I won't be, but Joanne will be signing some more copies of the book later before we go home. So Joanne's here to tell us all about Strawberry Thief. You've been doing about a week of events so far, is that right?
Yes, I've done some pre-publication events, and then yesterday was the official publication date, so this is basically the beginning of the tour, in spite of the week of events I've done before that. And it will continue into May, and there'll be odd things here and there. But it's so nice to be here, and it's so nice to see so many of you. Thank you for coming.
Well, we're very excited that you're here. And, of course, the book has had quite a lot of attention as well. I mean, I think you were on Woman's Hour yesterday.
And, I was, yes. I do Woman's Hour, you know, because my mother was Jenny Murray's French teacher. And she still has a little bit of a crush on her, I think.
And Good Housekeeping magazine did a nice big spread of you as well. And lots of coverage all over the place. And why not? It's capturing a lot of attention because we all feel so warmly towards Chocolat, and this is the fourth instalment of the Chocolat story. But 20 years since that first book came out. How do you feel about that?
20 years, I feel old. And a bit surprised, actually. I don't think of it as the fourth instalment of a story. I think of it as the fourth story in something which is an ongoing sequence of stories and which might well have a fifth story. So, you know, it is something that's not quite finished yet and may never be finished, of course, but it's a story that's been following me for all this time. And I'm so pleased that people still care about those characters, because otherwise there wouldn't be any more books.
And we need to explore that a little bit more as well. But can you take us back to how Chocolat came about then? So how that book, because it was a little bit different from what you've been writing before, and it wasn't your first book, it was your third, I think.
It was my third book. It was completely different to what I'd been writing before, but then what I had been writing before wasn't quite in my voice. I think the thing about writers is that some of them find their writing voice quite early, and some kind of take their time over it, and initially, I didn't really have a writing voice. What I was very good at doing was copying other people's voices. I still can do this, but much of my writing was pastiching other writers. And so my first book was a sort of pastiche of the Victorian Gothic novel. And my second book was definitely a Wilkie Collins pastiche. And I kind of tried out a number of different voices, and this is one of the reasons that I still write in multiple voices, because I like doing it and I like playing with how voices interact. With Chocolat, I think I more or less found my own voice, and some of that I think had to do with having my daughter and the way I saw the world after that. It was a slightly different world perspective, and I started thinking more about other people than about myself, and that gave my writing a slightly different direction. And so Chocolat is the first book that I'd written where the character was a parent. And it was the first book that I'd written where the voice felt like it was more like my voice than it had been before.
So how did you respond to the reception that it had? Because it was quite a phenomenal reaction to that book, wasn't it?
How did I respond to it? Initially, by feeling low-grade anxiety all the time for about 5 years. Initially, when it first happened, I thought, well, this is just ridiculous. It's not going to last. I'd been told that books like that wouldn't sell. I had already showed my agent previous manuscripts that were to become published later, but which he said were unpublishable. books like Blackberry Wine and Five Chords of the Orange, both of which hit number one in the charts when they did come out. But no, they were unpublishable because they were too different, they were too old-fashioned. They were unfashionably about small communities and food and relationships and all kinds of things that nobody's interested in. And so, you know, I thought this just can't really be happening. And then it just went on happening, and then the movie happened. And every time I thought I'd kind of got a handle on what was happening, something else happened, and it became quite alarming for a while, and then I kind of settled into it. And I was a teacher for a long time. I was the child of teachers, the grandchild of a teacher. I had been brought up from the cradle to believe that I was going to be a teacher, and indeed I did become a teacher, and for 15 years I taught, and I was good at it, and I had a pension, and I did all the things that my mother felt qualified as having a proper job. And then I gave it all up to be a writer, and she still hasn't quite forgiven me.
But why do you think then that book did touch such a nerve with so many people? Why do you think that it was so successful then and has continued to be so?
It's hard to tell. I'm not entirely sure that I know. I can kind of guess because I've heard people talk to me about the books and what it's meant to them. I think it was a combination of factors. One was that at the time, the fashionable books in the literary world were very different. The literary world was going through a bit of a Puritan phase. All the books that got prizes and were getting attention were extremely realistic, rather bleak in tone, and stylistically very much pared down. There was a whole little movement going on in London that called itself the New Puritans, with all the melancholy implications that you might expect from a group called the New Puritans. These were mostly earnest young things that had decided to remove all the description and all the adjectives out of their prose. And they were all writing about very serious, very earnest things. And then along came Chocolat, and it was just full of splashy prose and colours and descriptions and tastes and food. And it also had this definitely un-Puritan message that it was actually all right to enjoy life and to forgive yourself for the little things that you did wrong and to enjoy the little things that actually give you pleasure. And I think it must have been a bit of a palate cleanser for some people. Mm. And I also think that people fell for the characters. People just liked those characters and wanted to know what was going to happen to them. Certainly I wanted to know what was going to happen to them, and that always helps if the author wants to know. Usually the author can kind of jolly the public along in that case, and I think maybe that's what happened.
But is it 7 years since the last, not instalment, but story?
I lose track. I think it's about 7 years. I think what happens, people sometimes get a little bit confused about why I write the way I do and why I have this kind of breadth of different interests. And I've worked it out, finally, after 30 years of being published. I've worked out that I'm actually a spaceship on an elliptical orbit around a number of different satellites. And one is the village of Lansquenet-sur-Tarn, where Chocolat was set. And one is St. Oswald's boys' school, where Gentlemen and Players is set. And another is my version of Asgard, where my rune books were set, and there are also some kind of funny little one-off satellites which are just kind of flying around, which get visited. And the orbit takes about 7 years. And so I will return to these places every 7 years or so, and by then there is usually a story there for me to collect. But that's how it works with me. And so this is one of the reasons why these books have taken such a long time to be written. And the other reason, I think, is simply that because Chocolat was so much about the relationship between a mother and her daughter, and because when I wrote it, I had a child of four, and it was easy for me to write from the perspective of the mother of a child of four, not so easy to write from the perspective of a mother of an adolescent child. And so I had to wait until my version of Anouk, my daughter Anoushka, reached the right age for me then to take her to the next step and to take Vian as a mother to the next step.
But the people have often made these comparisons between you and your characters, particularly you and Fiona. So how do you feel about that, sort of the books mirroring your life?
Well, they do and they don't. I mean, of course, I've written a lot of books where people have mostly, and I think rightly, assumed that I was not those characters. It doesn't mean, though, that I'm not entirely not those characters. I think, you know, there's a little bit of me in all my characters, including the thoroughly unpleasant ones, because otherwise I wouldn't have written them and I wouldn't have wanted to write them. I think it's sometimes a bit tempting to assume that I am Vian. I am really not, and yet we do have some things in common. I wouldn't have written about her if we didn't have some things in common, but there are also some things that I don't think of as being like me at all. I think what we mostly have in common is a strong bond with our child, or in Vian's case, children, a certain view of how life should be lived, and a general, shall we say, predisposition to enjoy food. Beyond that, I'm not really like her at all. She's in some ways the opposite of me.
But didn't you have a lot of attention from young men after the film?
Oh, the offers of marriage. Oh, yes, I got offers of marriage, and lots of them, actually. I think people were quite disappointed to find out that I wasn't Vian and that I wasn't Juliette Binoche, and it was just me. But yes, I got the offers of marriage and the Valentines made of hair and various things for a while until people figured it out, and until I'd written a few other things and people worked out that it wasn't, you know, I wasn't really that person. But yes, it's I think it's part of the voodoo of writing books, and I think, you know, I take it as a compliment, even though it can be a little alarming, that people feel so invested in the stories that they assume that they're real. I think that's a wonderful compliment for a writer, for you to think that the books and the people and the places are real, and particularly the places. Because, of course, Lansquenet is a kind of amalgam of French villages in more or less the Gers region of France. But from the letters that I've had over 20 years, people have found that village absolutely everywhere. People have written to me wanting to know exactly how to find it, because they can't find that particular tributary of the Garonne, and they assume that their maps must be wrong. People have gleefully announced that they found it and they had their honeymoon there. And sometimes the people who said that they found it hadn't even found it in France. It's been in Belgium, it's been in I even got a letter from a Japanese gentleman who wrote to me in Japanese, which is a language that I don't speak. Fortunately, my brother does. And he translated it for me. And this was probably the biggest compliment I've had on those lines. It was a letter that said, "Dear Mrs. Harris, I understand that you need to maintain this persona of being a British writer. I understand that it's probably better commercially for you to do this, but I know your secret. I know that you're actually Japanese. The reason I know this is that I live in your village," which is just a little village in Okinawa, and I just happen to live there, and I have recognised all my neighbours and myself. And so I know that you're here somewhere and I will find you out. And even now, years after receiving this letter, I do look at the audience from time to time. I just wonder if he's here. If he is, I'm going to buy him a pint.
But people do like to believe in the reality of your stories and your places and your characters. But sometimes they don't like what you've done with your characters, certain things that happen to Vian, for example.
I haven't done anything with Vian. Life is the thing that changes characters. It's not authors. The thing that I think people need to understand about characters is that you can have obedient characters who do what you say as an author and obey instructions, or you can have living characters who disobey and misbehave And sometimes they die and you don't want them to, and sometimes they do things that you don't want them to, and sometimes they change in ways that you find surprising or disconcerting, and this is the sign of a character who has come to life. Mm. And I think that Vian became one of those characters, and the fact that I've written the books with such long intervals between stories, I think it was inevitable that the characters were going to change. If I had decided to do what my publishers would have loved me to do, which was to write Chocolat 2 the year after Chocolat, and then Chocolat 3 the next year, I would be on to Chocolat 20 now, and I would be in the Royal Albert Hall, and there would be like 5,000 of you, and I would be a billionaire. And that never happened because I couldn't do this. I couldn't have done it. Then Vian would probably not have changed. But the fact that I kept revisiting Vian over different periods of her life, sometimes difficult periods. People do go through periods of self-doubt and unhappiness, and the challenges of life catch up with them. And actually, those are the things that make stories happen.
Mm. Yes. And then we relate to the characters all the more for going through their troubles, perhaps. But but I understand that when you... The trigger, perhaps... even though you got your 7-year orbit for writing this book, was doing the audio for Chocolat. At least made you revisit that book. How was that experience?
It did. It wasn't the trigger for writing the book, but I think it possibly shaped some of the things that happened within the writing of the book. I was about a quarter of the way through The Strawberry Thief when I was asked to record the full-length audiobook of Chocolat. There hadn't been a full-length audiobook for years and years, and they wanted a new one, and so I did that. And it was actually the first time that I'd reread Chocolat. I don't go back and reread my books. It's a profoundly uncomfortable thing to do. It's like looking at old photographs of yourself from the 80s, and you think, really, I wore that? Or, in my case, it was really, I put all those adverbs in there. But what I did see was that I put all kinds of things in the book that I haven't really been conscious of having put in there. I realised that it was a story with a lot more anxiety and fearfulness in it than I thought that I'd written. And this was entirely because of my life and the things that had happened in my life. And I realised that actually there was a lot in Chocolat already, a sort of foreshadowing of loss and guilt and fear and all kinds of things that I really didn't properly understand until 20 years later when I was writing this follow-up. And so it's because it's a story about the relationship between a mother and her children again, and because Chocolat is about the mother of a small child and The Strawberry Thief is about the mother of an adult child and another child on the cusp of adulthood, I realised that there were a number of unfinished narratives in Chocolat that I probably wouldn't have revisited in quite the same way if I hadn't really studied the book in that way and read it aloud and properly inhabited it again. And it was also great to get that reminder of that voice. It's never been far from me anyway. I've never found it difficult to do Vian's voice, but Vian's voice as a much younger woman resonated quite strongly with me at that point, and in a way that kind of surprised me, and so it found its way into the book, and so to me The Strawberry Thief is much closer to Chocolat than Lollipop Shoes or Peaches for Monsieur le Curé, and in some ways it kind of closes the circle and it answers a lot of questions which people might have asked at the end of Chocolat and not expected an answer to, and then it's a little late, but here they are anyway.
So can you tell us a brief description of how you would sum up The Strawberry Thief then? What can we expect?
Okay, well, first you don't need to have read any of the previous books, although it helps if you want to expand that world and understand some of those connected relationships, but you don't actually have to. However, 16 years have passed since the events of Chocolat, not quite 20 in real time, but close enough. Vian Rocher has finally more or less settled down in Lansquenet-sur-Tarn. She is running her chocolate shop and has been doing it for some years. her eldest daughter Anouk, who is now in her 20s, is living in Paris with her boyfriend. He comes back occasionally. Her younger daughter Rosette is now just 16 and is living with her in the chocolate shop. Rosette is different. She's always been different. We don't really know exactly what is different about her. We don't quite understand what her condition is, but she is largely non-verbal. She mostly communicates in noises, in bird sounds, in singing, and in drawing. She is extremely good at drawing, and uses it as a means of expressing herself. She does have a voice, but she doesn't use it very often. She has what she calls a shadow voice, which she thinks of as too dangerous to use. And she doesn't think that it quite belongs to her, and so she doesn't use it. But her voice on the page is very strong. She's got a very strong internal world. She lives partly in a fantasy world. She has a kind of magic of her own, and she's very much a free spirit. She doesn't go to school. She doesn't really interact with other children. She has one friend, but he's a boy, and he's now at that age where he doesn't play with girls anymore. So she's quite a lonely little girl. And she has been, unbeknown to Vianne, befriended by the local florist, Narcisse, who is grumpy and taciturn and doesn't seem to like many people in the village at all. He quite likes Roux, who is also grumpy and taciturn. He hates Renaud the priest, and always has done. And when he dies, finally, his remaining family, his daughter, is infuriated to find that although he has left her the farm, he has left Rosette the wood. And it's quite a large parcel of land with some commercial value, and Narcisse's daughter doesn't understand why he has left it all to this girl who can't even talk and who won't appreciate it. And she assumes that something sinister must be afoot. Narcisse also leaves his written confession, which is a big manuscript, which he leaves to Renaud. And Renaud, who is always disliked, feels personally attacked by this because he has to read it, because it's his duty. And he also feels a little nervous because he knows that Narcisse knew him when he was a boy and therefore is privy to various things in his past that he isn't proud of and that he would quite like not to read about. And there are a number of narratives that start off as separate and then come together to make one story, and there is a mystery of why Narcisse has left his wood to Rosette. There is the mystery of what exactly is going on with Rosette. There's the mystery of Narcisse's confession. There is the mystery of Renaud's past. And people who have read Chocolat very carefully and remember it in great detail will know that there is one big unanswered question mark over Renaud, and has been all these years. And then there is the mystery of the new arrival in the village, who is a woman who moves into Narcisse's old florist, but it's not a florist anymore. And this is a woman who arrives in the village in much the same way that Vianne arrived in the village 16 years before, and has the same effect on the villagers. Some of them are drawn to her, others immediately mistrust her, and she has got powers not entirely dissimilar to Vianne's powers. And I shan't tell you too much more about her, because I'd quite like you to find out for yourselves.
Well, then I don't know whether to ask the next question.
Ask away.
I've heard you mention it elsewhere, so I'm going to say it anyway. Tattoos feature quite prominently in this story.
They do, yes.
So why did you introduce that? What do they mean to you in this book?
Well, tattooing is an interesting art. It's very old. It has had huge amounts of folklore and belief and history and spirituality behind it. It's also had a lot of prejudice around it. It has also had magical significance imbued to it. And so, very like chocolate making, in fact, it has got this folkloric, magical history. And these two strands of different kinds of folklore kind of run alongside each other in the story. It's also a story about marking. And so thematically it fits in very nicely. It's a story about patterns and how patterns repeat, and how life marks us, and how we mark events, and how we mark other people without realising that we do it. And so there is that aspect in there. One of the reasons it's called The Strawberry Thief is you are, some of you perhaps, familiar with the pattern by William Morris. It's a pattern that some people like and some people dislike. It's quite a dense, moving, hallucinatory pattern in some way, and it's about mirroring shapes. And in this book, Vian and the new owner of Narcissa's shop mirror each other in all sorts of ways, and also perhaps mark each other. And this is something that every book that I've written about Vian has put her opposite somebody who mirrored some facet of her character in some way and changed her in some way. With Chocolat, and I might have just turned off my thing. Yeah, that's better.
Your battery might be going down.
With Chocolat, it was Renaud, who has now mellowed, and I think we're all right for a minute. And he's become, this is very rock and roll. And he's become a reasonably acceptable person, but he's still coming to terms with actually joining the human race. With the lollipop shoes, it was Zosie de l'Alba, who's probably one of my favourite villains, who is a kind of negative, thank you, a negative mirror image of Fian with peaches for Monsieur le Curé. It is a Muslim woman in a niqab who has all sorts of stories told about her and who is viewed by the villagers in a very particular way because of her culture and her refusal to show her face, and who has a story, which we find out about later. And in this case, it is Morgane, the tattooist, who again also has a story and who has something to teach Vian. Vian is not as wise as people have assumed she was in Chocolat. I never thought Vian was particularly a design for living. She's very, very good at solving other people's problems, but she's also not great at solving her own. And this becomes apparent in some of these stories and these meetings, because in every case, Vian learns a little bit more, grows a little bit more, is changed a little bit more by the encounter.
So we haven't actually talked yet about the presence of food, well, to any great extent, which is so powerful in your books. But it isn't just food, it's the whole central aspect of your writing, the colour, the taste. And you've actually developed a scent with this book as well. So can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of sensuality of your writing, but also how this scent came about?
Well, I think because I tend to experience the world primarily through scents and colours. Not everybody does this. Some people are very much more likely to notice rhythms or sounds or shapes. We all have a dominant scent with scents. With me, it's kind of mostly scents and colours. Partly because I smell colours also, which is a completely different area of perception, which often confuses people. But this is probably why I write so much about colours and scents. And I've also been, fairly recently in the last few years, exploring different ways of disseminating narratives. Because, I mean, we were talking about audiobooks beforehand. An audiobook is a very different thing to words on the page. It's a different experience. It's a different way of conveying that story. Reading aloud is different from me just telling you a story. That has a slightly different identity, but it's still the same story. It's still a vehicle for a story. Pictures, illustrations next to text give a different dimension to a story. And I've been working with an illustrator for the last couple of books, and that's been interesting because it has been a slightly different storytelling experience. I've told stories on Twitter, which again is strange because it's not quite the same as telling stories to an audience, and yet you do have an audience. It's not quite the same as writing stories down, although you are writing them down. It feels a lot more like the oral tradition. I've taken stories into music with my Storytime show and the band, using music to illustrate stories. And I thought, well, you know, what haven't I used? I haven't used scent. Why not? Scent has a narrative of its own. Scent can possibly illustrate stories. And so I because I have been involved with the Fragrance Foundation, which is the organisation behind the perfume industry, I ended up telling my various theories about scent illustrations to stories to somebody who turned out to be a perfumer, and he said that he would make me a scent for The Strawberry Thief if I gave him a suitable passage of narrative that he could illustrate. And so I chose a piece of writing, and I said, okay, this is the scene. What would you create around it? And so he made me a scent, which I have been using in various events, and I've been spritzing people's books with it. If you want your book spritzed at the end, I will be more than happy to share the scent with you. But yes, and I just wanted to see if it would add anything to the experience and make it develop in a different way. Because I'm slightly obsessed with the idea of immersive writing, the idea that I try to put as many sense impressions into my writing as possible so that the experience is for you as fully immersive as possible. It's not just pictures on a flat screen. It has depth, it has taste, it has scent, it has music.
And there was a phase when novelists were adding playlists alongside their books as well. And I understand that you sometimes have playlists to get yourself in the mood for writing, is that?
Yes, I often have playlists. I don't use them when I'm actually writing because I read aloud a lot when I'm writing and it would interfere with the rhythms of what I was doing. But I often have playlists to kind of get me in the mood or to remind me of the kind of time that I'm supposed to be writing from. I mean, sometimes I've published the playlist, and when I wrote Blue Eyed Boy, which is mostly set online, there were songs included in the story, and there was a playlist which, if you wanted to download it from Spotify, you could actually play it, and you could have that alongside the reading experience, and people who wanted to go into the minute details of the song lyrics would find clues as to what was going on in the book and so on. It was, again, that was a form of illustration.
So how did you feel about the scent?
Oh, I liked it. I liked it very much. It's very strong. I used it to scent the proofs with and to scent the pages of the special edition of the Waterstones book that has the extra intro in it. And I've been using it to sort of waft over audiences in the hope that they will get a little bit of it. But you know, scenting books works. A lot of people have been sniffing my books and
yes, well, a lot of people smell books anyway, don't they?
But they do, yes, books have a very particular smell. In fact, there's a perfume by L'Artisan Parfumeur that actually smells of books.
Oh.
Okay. It's a perfume called Zing, which smells of books. It smells of paper. It's amazingly weird. I love it. I'm not sure I actually want to smell of books, but it's a very, very interesting,
well, yes,
very interesting, well-built scent.
So you said about the immersive experience for the reader. How do you get into the mood, if you like, for writing? What do you have to discipline yourself, or is it a joyful thing? I mean, what is writing for you?
If it were anything to do with discipline, I probably wouldn't do it because apparently I don't have any, according to my mother. No, this is entirely joy. I wouldn't write if I didn't love it, if I didn't get pleasure out of doing it. I wouldn't have given up my proper job and my pension and all the other things. So really, getting into the mood has never been the problem with me. The problem with me has always been getting time, clawing back time from all the other things that I do to actually do the thing that I'm supposed to do, which is writing the book. I'm quite good at getting into the zone quickly. Part of this is because my first three books were written when I was still a teacher and I didn't have a lot of time, and so I didn't have the luxury of being able to sort of do my yoga and my pelvic floor exercises and burn a scented candle and then maybe, you know, a prayer to a higher power and cast a magic circle. I actually just had to get down and do it because I sometimes only had 20 minutes and you know, I didn't have much else. So I'm quite good at sort of the focus. Very often I have used Twitter as my first point of, as my kind of little Zen exercise. Because I tend to write in my shed in the garden, I often start off the day on Twitter by saying what the shed is doing. This started about 7 years ago when I joined Twitter, and the Shed developed a personality of its own. It now has a persona, which means that it changes appearance and location every day. And so sometimes it can be a rocket ship, and sometimes it can be a balloon. And sometimes if I'm in a really bad mood, it's just a shed. And people on Twitter will go, "Are you all right?" But yes, it's and once I've done that, I'm pretty much able to get down to work.
And how do you find being away from the Shed? So tours like this, are you able to find any time on trains or hotel rooms to do any writing, or is this?
Yes, definitely. I'm quite good at writing in hotel rooms and on trains. And also because so much of writing time is not actually sitting at a desk. So much of it is thinking time and mulling things over time and planning time. When I was a teacher, I really didn't have much time to write except at weekends. But I found that if I could just keep thinking... me and machinery. If I could just keep thinking about the story, and if I could just keep it kind of bubbling over in my mind, then I would have all the ideas that I needed to by the weekend. I could just get them down as fast as possible. And so, yeah, there's that. I've never really needed ideal circumstances, which is good because I rarely get them.
Okay, right. Well, I've asked quite a few questions. Does anybody have questions of their own that they'd like to ask Joanna?
Yes, over here.
It must have been very exciting seeing the book being turned into a film. Were you actually very involved in that process? Were you involved in the screenplay and the filming, or was it just taken off you?
It wasn't taken off me. I sold it, which is quite an important thing, really. The choice is always the author's to concede rights to somebody or not. And I think that... I was very new to the whole concept, and I was very happy just to let them do the thing, which was good because I think, you know, if I'd come to it with the desire to have any kind of creative control, I might have been quite upset by the whole thing, because most authors that I know who have had books made into movies have not really enjoyed the experience. I did enjoy it. I actually had a great time. But that was mostly because I, first of all, wasn't quite sure that it was ever going to happen. It just seemed like it was just a fairy tale and that, you know, it was never going to happen. And so I kind of spent the whole process just expecting it to fall apart at any moment. And of course it didn't. But I was told by my friend Chris Fowler, who's also a writer, but who worked in film at the time, and he said, well, you know, the thing to do when you sign a movie deal is don't expect anything. Don't believe anything until you're there at the premiere watching the credits roll. And so I did exactly that. I just let it happen. And when I was told that they'd optioned the movie, I let that happen. And then when Juliette Binoche phoned me at home and said that she wanted to come read the script with me and stay at my house, I let that happen. And then they said, you want to come on set and see what's going on? I thought, okay, that's fine. And I was very, very calm and collected until I was actually at the premiere watching the credits roll, and then I had a moment of intense panic, fainted, and continued to do this on regular occasions for the next 6 months at every public event I was at.
Oh.
I would just black out like Tony Soprano. And I think it was like, at this point, I think I'd just reached the point at which experience just became so traumatic that I just tilted every now and again. And so I've passed out at 4 film premieres. St James's Palace, I know at least, possibly Windsor Castle also. Lots of very glitzy venues indeed. And then it just stopped happening, and I think life caught up with me again, and I thought, okay, this is fine. I'm now back on an even keel. As for writing the script, I was asked to do it, and I said no, which was a good thing, because I'd never even read a movie script, let alone written one, and it would have been disastrous. I mean, quite apart from the fact that I was still teaching full-time and that I was a public examiner, and also I had a small child. And also there was the fact that I lived in Barnsley and, you know, I couldn't just kind of jet off to LA every time they wanted a script meeting, which would have been like every week. Mm. And so I just let them do it, and it was much, much better that way. I just kind of sat and enjoyed the ride, which was great, and it was a lot of fun.
Did it affect your writing afterwards, particularly the Schoffler, writing the characters after seeing the film?
No, I think with me, the thing is, I have a unique and privileged perspective. I already knew what all the characters looked like before they made the film. Not everybody did, and so people who saw the film first found that they sometimes saw the characters from the screen in the book. People who'd read the book first, that didn't happen, and they would then write to me, sometimes indignantly going, "Ah, I didn't think that so-and-so was going to play that, and that was completely wrong." Most people agreed with me that Juliette Binoche was a very good fit for Vianne. Some people had difficulty with Renaud, particularly as they morphed him into a kind of weird aristocratic mayor figure, having forgotten, of course, being American, that actually the French guillotined all their aristocrats, and so there aren't any left. But yeah, I mean, it was still very close to my story, and I didn't feel that they'd kind of removed its character in that way, which was good. They could have done. They could have set it in space. They could have set it in America, which would have been much worse.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
The magic realism, which is often present, is that something that interested you beforehand, or did it sort of arrive of its own volition?
And magic realism was a question.
Yeah, I don't really know what magic realism is supposed to mean. Either you think magic is real or you don't. It's like saying electricity realism. And because I write about magic in a certain way, if it feels real, then it's because it is real. I think, you know, because I kind of span a reasonably broad spectrum of realism versus fantasy in my books. So there are the psychological thrillers, which have very little fantasy element, if any. I would say that actually they do, but that's another long answer. There are the fantasy books, which have proper out-and-out pyrotechnics and you know, fantasy creatures. And then there are these stories set in France in the middle where you can actually read them any way you like. You can read them entirely as realism. You can read them where the magic doesn't actually exist. You can say the magic is a metaphor for something, or you can say, okay, she's a witch. I wanted to leave it relatively open, because to me the idea was the question was never going to be, is the magic real? The question was going to be, I can do magic. Why can't I be like this? Because, you know, Vianne was never supposed to be a special person. Her magic, if you want to call it that, is really entirely common sense. It's all about kindness, it's about tolerance, it's about the kind of qualities that anybody can have. It's not about sort of privileged magic or hereditary magic or going to Hogwarts magic. It's very much about how, with the right kind of perspective, anybody could do those things. So, I mean, having said that, I'm interested in folklore. I'm interested in the kind of the traditional beliefs that have informed so much of literature and so much of European folklore. And I wanted to use some of that too, because I was also writing about belief and faith and religion and superstition and myth, and I wanted them all to be in the same kind of area of treatment. So, yes, one person's myth is another person's religion, depending on when and where you're alive and what you happen to believe.
Thank you. Okay, any others? Yes?
When I read your book, Creatures for Monsieur Le Curé, I felt the need. I had to go and buy peach jam. So to me, you got over the scent of the food in that book in a remarkable way. Am I unusual?
No, I think quite a lot of people have accused me of making them put on weight and want to eat this. And if this is true, then I'm delighted, and it's a wonderful thing to through squiggles on a page make somebody want to eat chocolate or peaches or whatever. I think this is something to do, though, with the way readers approach reading. I think the more you immerse yourself in a book, the more will come out from the page. Or at least this is the way it's supposed to work. I mean, to me, the thing that flatters me most when people tell me about their experience reading my books is when they say it made me hungry, or it made me laugh, or it made me cry, or it made me miss my tube stop, or something like this, because it means that I managed to get across what I wanted to get across. You became immersed. And so I do think of it as a sort of voodoo, and when it works, it's a wonderful thing.
But I am intrigued by this synesthesia that you have.
Yes.
Can you just sum up what that is, please?
It's really hard for me to explain what synesthesia is, because for a start, anybody who has it in a very individual way and doesn't have it like anybody else. Basically, with me, with any person with synesthesia, it's where their perceptions, their senses tend to overlap into something else in an unusual way. So some people can hear colours as musical sounds. Some people can taste words. Quite a lot of people seem to experience colours as music or music as colours. I experience colours as scent quite a lot of the time. So depending on the colour, depending on the light, various colours will trigger various scents. And most of them are not unpleasant, and some of them are very unpleasant, but fortunately the very unpleasant ones don't tend to pop up quite as often. That awful yellow stuff which is growing in the fields at the moment, the oilseed rape, triggers the most disgusting smell. And because I'm going to be on a lot of trains, I'm going to see a hell of a lot of it, and everything is going to smell of fish for about 3 weeks, and it will be just a bad, bad thing. But other than that, it's quite a good experience for me, and this is why I tend to notice scents and colours before I notice anything else. I will walk into a room, and if there is a certain kind of red dominating, then that room will just smell of chocolate until the red goes away. Or until I shut my eyes, and then I'll be able to actually smell what the room really smells of.
Goodness.
Does it have to be a large colour?
No, not always. It
could
just
be like somebody's jumper in the audience.
Yes, it could be some. I mean, definitely there are several people triggering chocolate for me at the moment. there are also people sort of triggering a floral scent, and somebody triggering diesel oil. Nobody's triggering the fish, fortunately, which is good.
Work in reverse? Do you see colours if you smell a scent?
No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work in reverse at all. I have to shut my eyes if I'm smelling something, so that I know exactly that that's what other people will be smelling, and that it won't have a load of synesthetic colour smells coming at me as well.
Did you have this as a child?
I did have it as a child, but I didn't know what it was. It took me until I was in my 20s to realise that not everybody was like this. And when I kept saying the chocolate one, when I meant the red one, I didn't realise for quite a long time that nobody, literally nobody, understood what I was saying. Finally I did, and I saw a documentary about synesthesia, and a kind of little light bulb went up, and I went, oh, that's what it is.
Very good. Okay, yes. Oh, no question. Yes, at the back, yes.
I think the first inspiration I remember was Ray Bradbury. But I still go back to him. He's a wonderful writer. He's a tremendously evocative writer. He's a master of language, but he's also a great storyteller. I go back to him all the time. I read a lot of French authors when I was a kid, because my mother is French. Most of the books that we had in our house were in French. And there was this author called Georges Cholet, who you won't have heard of unless you read French, because I don't think he's ever been published in any other country, but he was vastly popular. He was a sort of version of Enid Blyton for French children, and he wrote hundreds of books about this schoolgirl superheroine called Fantomette, who solved all kinds of mysteries, and I read many, many books by him. when I got into my teens, I kind of discovered people like Mervyn Peake and Nabokov and people whose written style I found so fascinating that I wanted to look at stylists. And I still go back to all of those, including Fantomet, who I read and reread for my daughter when she reached the age at which she would enjoy them.
And your daughter's a writer too, so how does that work in the family? Do you share ideas, or do you read each other's work before it gets sent to us?
Not so much. I sometimes bounce ideas off Anushka, and sometimes she bounces them off me. But she is very different to me. She has a very different style. She has a very different approach. And I think it's quite natural that she shouldn't show me stuff too early.
Mm.
She's very good, I think, but she's also extremely careful to let things take their time. She's not impulsive as a writer at all. And so when she shows me something, I will read it. But I don't kind of go pestering her, because I don't think with her it would work at all.
Okay, a couple more questions? Yes, thank you.
Do you handwrite manuscripts, or are you a laptop?
No, I write on a laptop. I write straight to laptop and have done for many, many years. I do carry notebooks around, and I will occasionally write ideas down in a notebook if I don't have any access to anything else, but honestly it's so much easier to just write on a laptop that I always do that.
Yes.
I like the way you kind of convey the idea that your characters really have a life of their own, and that sometimes they kind of their life takes a turn that you hadn't yourself anticipated. But then I'd always thought that an author would have a fairly clear-cut kind of narrative and tale set out, so they knew, as it were, where their destination was going to be.
You'd think, wouldn't you? This is the case with me. It is with some people. Some writers I know are extremely careful to plan out everything scene by scene and to know exactly where they're going. I don't do that. I do the opposite almost intentionally. It's a bit of a messy process, but because so much of what I write is based on twists and reversals and surprises, I have to leave some space for me to be surprised, because otherwise I don't think I would convincingly surprise the reader. And so what I tend to do is I will start off with a vague kind of trajectory, but I won't always know the details, and sometimes there'll be big holes that I know will have to be filled at some point. And sometimes I write the story backwards, and sometimes I write it episodically and then kind of match it together later at the end. There has never been a proper uniform way of doing it for me. All books are different. They all find their own trajectory. Some of them are easy to write. Some of them are extremely complicated. The great thing about laptops and Microsoft Word is that actually at the end, you can actually hide all that process, and the end result is a book. And if it works, it works. But no, I'm not one of those meticulous planners at all. And I do like to be surprised. I like something to come out at me and go, yes, this is a thing that was missing here, and I understand why it fits in here, but I hadn't realised it would be there until I got to it.
Okay, one more, yes.
Sorry, just to carry on from what you were saying, do you believe, therefore, that the story is already there, and you're panelling it and piecing it together as a jigsaw? And in that sense, it's magical, and that's coming through you as an author, if that makes sense.
Because it makes sense.
Because you're not writing out a story in advance, it's a sort of magical channeling, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting that you would say that. Ray Bradbury used to have on his typewriter a little card that said official Ouija board. and he definitely felt that he was channeling something. I think sometimes it can definitely feel that way. Very often I find myself writing in a kind of fugue state, and at the end of the day or the next day when I reread it, I think, you know, do I really remember writing that? Where did that come from? There's certainly that element of it. I think you can look at it that way, or you can look at it as a sort of semi-conscious process. I don't really know. I just do it, and then I've still not quite figured out how it happens or exactly what the process is, because you know, let's face it, dreaming for a living is not a normal thing to do.
So what's next? What will you be working on next? Can you tell us anything
about that? I always work on a number of things at once. I think partly it's a fear of not having anything to do. I've got a new one in my rune series that I'm just beginning to work on, which I'm just kind of just starting. I've got another novella, which is finished but not edited. And I'm working with Howard Goodall on a musical about Pre-Raphaelite women, which hopefully we'll start putting on in a small theatre in autumn, and then hopefully workshop it and try and get it into bigger theatres later. And so those are the projects I'm working on at the moment. I'm bound to gather another one at some point, because projects seem to come to me, and I find it really hard to say no, especially when they're really fun projects.
Well, we're glad that you don't say no, because this is just a fantastic book. I'm sure you'll agree when you read it for yourselves. I did get a sneak preview, so I loved it, and I'm sure we all will. Thank you so much for a brilliant book and for a lovely evening. So
thank you.